Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of the South Fork. All who come here are welcome. My name is John Andrews. I've been a member of this congregation for 10.5 years now. I'd like to thank Nancy Remkes for sharing her musical gifts with us this morning. And I'd also like to thank the Reverend Galen Gingrich, who is senior minister of the Unitarian Church of All Souls in New York City. Galen has written a book called God Revised, which has many good ideas on how religion needs to evolve in a scientific age. He rises above hidebound notions of God inherent in much traditional religion, but also the utter rejection of God inherent in militant atheism. And to use a metaphor I've used before from the Odyssey, what I find in here is that of a Ulysses finding a way home between two monsters, the Scylla of scientism and the Charybdis of Crete. And because I too want to be on that ship, I am honored to be the worship associate for this service.
Thank you.
Ours is a shared ministry. Our minister, the Reverend Kimberly Quinn Johnson, leads worship 2 or 3 times a month. On other Sundays, the service is led by worship associates, members, and guest speakers. Our services are different from week to week, so if you're new to this congregation, we suggest that you attend several services to get a sense of the diversity of the worship experience here. A person will worship something. Have no doubt about that. We may think our tribute is paid in secret in the dark recesses of our hearts, but it will out. That which dominates our imaginations and our thoughts will determine our lives and character. Therefore, it behooves us to be careful what we worship, for what we are worshiping, we are becoming. The words of Ralph Waldo Emerson.
And again, good morning. Welcome. It's great to be back with you. I think I was here last summer, if I recall correctly. It's a wonderful thing to have this seasonal rhythm. I'm delighted that my wife, Holly Atkinson, is here with me. And I also want to say what a wonderful gift it was to All Souls to have Nancy Arnold with us for the past year. I know many of you know and love Nancy, and it was a real gift to have her pastoral presence with us. She helped lead our pastoral care efforts and our spiritual life groups over the past year. So that was a wonderful connection as well. We're going to be talking about hope this morning, hope in the middle of difficult times. And the first message this morning, which seems appropriate to a setting like this, is a poem about hope by one of my favorite poets about one of my favorite creatures. I brought a picture because why not? If it were my call, I would make Emily Dickinson the poet laureate of Unitarian Universalism. This is a well-known poem. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that kept so many warm. I've heard it in the chillest land and on the strangest sea, yet never in extremity it asked a crumb of me. We could spend all morning talking about this poem, but I would like to talk for a moment about hope being the thing with feathers that never stops at all. The Blackpoll Warbler, as some of you know, is a diminutive bird, size of a chickadee, but it is most well known for its extraordinary migration pattern. More pictures. These are the various migration patterns that the black pole warbler takes, but all go more or less from Canada to South America. In his book titled Season at the Point being Cape May, which is at the southern tip of New Jersey, Jack Connor describes how the black pole travels south from Canada to this point on the eastern coast of the U.S. between Cape Cod and Cape May. And there the black pole gathers its strength, feeding on insects and building fat reserves, until it has increased its body weight by up to 50%. And then on a night when the sky is clear and the winds are favorable, the black poles take to the sky, with their wings pumping constantly. As a warbler, the black pole cannot glide. They fly south, high above the ocean. Passing Bermuda at 6,500 feet, they meet the southeast trade winds and gain altitude, passing Antigua at 21,000 feet, until 90 hours and 1,500 miles later, these tiny little birds at last reach the coast of Venezuela. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. Our words of meditation come from the writings of the political philosopher Michael Walzer. This is taken from an essay first published in 2002 titled The Argument About Humanitarian Intervention. Walzer writes, "There is nothing new about human disasters caused by human beings. We have always been, if not our own, certainly each other's worst enemies. From the Assyrians in ancient Israel and the Romans in Carthage, to the Belgians in the Congo and the Turks in Armenia, history is a bloody and barbaric tale. Still, in this regard, the 20th century was an age of innovation, first and most important, in the way disasters were planned and organized, and then, more recently, in the way they were publicized. I want to begin with the second of these innovations, the product of an extraordinary speed-up in both travel and communication. It may be possible to kill people on a very large scale more efficiently than ever, but it is much harder to kill them in secret. In the contemporary world, there is very little that happens far away, out of sight, or behind the scenes. We are instant spectators of every atrocity. We sit in our living rooms and see the murdered children, the desperate refugees. Perhaps horrific crimes are still committed in dark places, but not many. Contemporary horrors are well lit. And so the question is posed that has never been posed before, at least not with such immediacy, never so inescapably. What is our responsibility? What should we do?" The words of Michael Walzer, whose questions we will now ponder in the silence. The Olympic Games have been a mostly welcome distraction from a world that otherwise seems very much in turmoil. Terrorist-related attacks have savaged wedding celebrations in Turkey, the streets of Baghdad, the promenade in Nice, the airport in Istanbul, and a nightclub in Orlando, among many other places. High-profile shootings by police of black men have increased tensions in St. Paul, Asheville, San Francisco, and many other places. And retributive shootings have killed police officers in Dallas and Baton Rouge. The climate is heating up, the Eurozone is breaking up, and Zika-infested mosquitoes are showing up. And then there is the intentionally fractious exercise of the fractionalizing form of government that we call democracy. To recast a familiar lyric from the Rolling Stones, while it may be true that we the people can always get what we want, at least in the aggregate, it's not at all clear that we will thereby get what we need. In addition, built-in sources of violence fester around the globe. As chasms of inequality deepen, as competition for water and other basic resources becomes fiercer, as millions of young men with no hope of a wife or a job become angrier and better armed, and as the backlash against women, both at home and abroad, becomes bolder and better organized. All told, it's almost enough to make one lose hope in humanity. About a year ago, a Yale senior named Emmy Mahmoud won the Individual World Poetry Slam competition in Washington, D.C. Originally from Darfur in Sudan, her family managed to escape the escalating violence in Darfur that eventually turned into genocide, fleeing first to Yemen when she was a toddler before coming to the United States. Once here, her parents, both writers, worked to raise awareness of the ongoing genocide in Darfur. At first, they tried to shield their children. They wanted to protect us from what was actually happening, Mahmoud said. When I insisted that they tell me, they did. I just picked up a pen and started writing and going on speaking tours with them. Over time, she became a poet. At the competition last year, Mahmoud's poems chronicled the tragedy of the genocide in Darfur, even as they celebrated the resilience of the human spirit. The poem that won her the championship reads, in part, "Let me tell you something about my mama. My mama is a woman, flawless and formidable in the same step. Woman walks in a war zone and has warriors cowering at her feet. My mama carries all of us in her body, on her face, in her blood, and blood is no good once you let it loose, so she holds us close. The last time we went home, we watched our village burn, soldiers pouring blood from civilian skulls, as if they too could turn water into wine. They stole the ground beneath our feet. The woman who raised me turned and said, 'Don't be scared. I'm your mother. I'm here. I won't let them through.'" The poem ends with these lines: "My mother and I can't walk the streets alone back home anymore. Back home, there are no streets to walk anymore." This poem powerfully chronicles the horrors that result when human beings face off against each other. In particular, when soldiers face off against civilians in a war zone. Historically speaking, however, there's something badly wrong with this picture. In the old days, soldiers fought against soldiers. not civilians. But something happened to war on the way to the 21st century. For men and women in uniform, war has become notably safer over the past few centuries. One out of every 7 American soldiers who fought in the Civil War was killed in the fighting, 1 out of 7. In the 2 world wars, the ratio dropped to 1 in 40 U.S. soldiers killed, 1 in 40. In Vietnam and Cambodia, 1 in 200 was killed. And in Iraq and Afghanistan, about 1 in 400 was killed. The ability to use planes, missiles, and drones to wage war at a distance has kept many more soldiers out of harm's way. But the opposite has been true for civilians caught in combat zones. Today, 90% of the casualties in armed conflicts are civilians, who end up being killed, wounded, or driven from their home by war. Many of these casualties are not simply the result of so-called collateral damage, the accidental side effects of a conflict between armed adversaries, especially in places like Syria, Sudan, Sierra Leone, Rwanda, and Bosnia. Civilians have also been specifically targeted by the strategic use of rape, mutilation, amputation, and genocide. When it comes to war in the 21st century, most of the dying is done by civilians. Civilians like the hapless villagers in Mahmoud's poems. And there's no sign that the dying is going to end anytime soon. The persistence of this level of carnage in the human experience has posed a thorny spiritual challenge to religious liberalism, a centuries-old tradition of which we are part. Religious liberalism tends to have a forward-looking view of history and an optimistic view of humanity. It rejects the Calvinist view of human beings as totally depraved. Instead, it generally believes that growth is inevitable, progress is irreversible, and human beings are perfectible. On these terms, there are no really bad people in the world, only people who, because of ignorance, negative influences, or lack of good options, end up doing bad things. Looking at human history from the perspective of Darfur, however, or Rwanda, or Bosnia, or Auschwitz, or even Syria. This list could go on approximately forever. It's hard to believe that growth is inevitable, that progress is irreversible, and human beings are perfectible. During the 1930s, a Unitarian theologian named James Luther Adams spent a considerable amount of time in Germany, where he observed firsthand the rise of Nazism. He made friends with a few religious leaders who covertly worked against the Nazis, even as he saw most German church leaders succumb to Hitler's demands. His experience convinced him that the basic tenets of religious liberalism needed to be revived. Adams spent 20 years on the faculty of Meadville Theological School in Chicago before joining the faculty of Harvard Divinity School for the remainder of his career. He went on to become the most influential Unitarian theologian of the 20th century. For our purposes this morning, I'd like to mention 2 things of which Adams made religious liberalism aware: the tragedy of history and the necessity of power. In his essay titled "The Changing Reputation of Human Nature," written in 1941, Adams says, "When we say that history is tragic, we mean that the perversions and failures in history are associated precisely with the highest creative powers of humanity, and thus with our greatest achievements. The very means and evidences of progress turn out again and again to be also instruments of perversion or destruction. Adams goes on to give several examples of this paradox. The national culture of a people, he says, their language, their poetry, their music, their common social heritage, is their most cherished treasure. Yet, he says, in a statement that is directly relevant to the American experience today, nationalism is also one of the most destructive forces in the whole of human history. Progress in transportation, he says, has raised the standard of living, yet it has also brought a new rootlessness and instability. Improved access to literacy has been a powerful instrument both for education and for demagoguery, and so on. Adams concludes, certainly if there is progress, it is no simple configuration of upward trends. At times it looks more like a thing of shreds and patches. The general tendency of liberalism has been to neglect this tragic factor in history. Because of this tragic factor, Adams insists that religious liberalism must come to terms with the necessity of power. He puts it this way: anything that exists effectively in history must have form, and the creation of a form requires power. It requires not only the power of thought, but also the power of organization and the organization of power. For Adams, both justice and injustice are forms of power. Injustice is the wanton abuse of institutional power, and justice is the lawful exercise of institutional power. Adams gathered his revised view of human history into what he called the five smooth stones of religious liberalism. These five smooth stones, which are probably Adams' best-known contribution to Unitarian Universalism, concern revelation, relationships, justice, agency, and hope. Here's a one-line summary of each of the five stones. Revelation isn't a once-and-done message from on high. We continue to learn new truths every day of our lives. Human relationships should be mutual and not coercive. Our highest moral obligation is to build just and loving human communities. Good things will happen only if we use our agency as human beings to make them happen. The resources we have available to make meaningful change in our world justify an attitude of ultimate optimism. The curious thing about this list is that Adams chose to describe the five essential qualities of religious liberalism as smooth stones. At first, this sounds like an immensely appealing metaphor. With smooth stones and some sand, you can construct a Zen garden, a focal point of calm and contemplation, of beauty and harmony. But Adams didn't get his five smooth stones from a Zen garden. There's a story in the Hebrew Bible that tells of a time when the people of Israel were battling for land with a rival group known as the Philistines. The Philistine champion was a fearsome warrior named Goliath, and none of the Hebrew soldiers had the courage to stand up to him. A young Hebrew boy named David had brought food and other supplies to his brothers who were engaged in the battle. Upon hearing Goliath's taunts and seeing the Hebrew soldiers respond in fear, David stepped forward and offered to take up the fight. At first, the Hebrew commanders refused David's offer, pointing out that he was a mere boy. But he persisted, and they finally, having no other options, relented. They tried suiting him up in armor, but David couldn't even walk in the clumsy outfit. So he took it off. The story continues. Then David took his staff in his hand and chose 5 smooth stones from the river and put them in his shepherd's bag. His sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. You may know the end of the story. After being mocked and ridiculed by Goliath, David took one of the smooth stones and put it in his sling. And he struck Goliath in the forehead, knocking him to the ground. David then approached Goliath and killed him with his own sword. This story certainly puts liberalism's 5 smooth stones into a somewhat different light. It forcefully illustrates Adam's point about power. It's a capability that can be wielded either for good or for ill. Which of these outcomes happened in the story of David and Goliath depends, of course, on whose side you're on, though the writer clearly views the outcome as good. In any event, Adam's point remains. History can turn out tragically if good people stand by and do nothing. And the story also illustrates Emmy Mahmoud's point. You don't have to be in uniform to fight the good fight. History can turn out tragically, but only if good people stand by and do nothing. The wise use of power in the pursuit of justice is not only permissible, it's necessary. And this is a struggle that all of us, each in our own way, must take up. Despite the tragedy that continues to bedevil history and the necessity to wield power in response, I agree with Adam. The resources we have available to make meaningful change in our world justify an attitude of ultimate optimism. There's always reason to hope. Emmy Mahmoud proclaims this conviction in her poem titled, There's Always Hope, in which she writes, even when everything in life seems wrong, and the path of violence seems so long, there is always hope to light your way each night and every day. Hope will always shine so bright, like moonlight on a patch of night. May it be so. Amen. I invite you to sing with me number 346 in your hymnal. Come sing a song with me.
Come sing a song with me.
Please remain standing as we say the words to extinguish our chalice printed in your order of service. We extinguish this flame,
but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts
until we are together again. I invite you to reach out to those nearby, holding hands or touching a shoulder. Feel the sense of community we all share. While we listen to these words of the prophet Isaiah, which you may recognize from one of our favorite hymns. The Spirit of God has sent me to bring good news to the oppressed, to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and release to the prisoners, to comfort all who mourn, to give them a garland instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, the mantle of praise instead of a faint spirit. They shall build up the ancient ruins. They shall raise up the former devastations, the devastations of many generations. You shall be named ministers of our God.